So that's a really challenging thing. Anytime we're doing any of this hurricane relief work or anything like that, you're going into not only an area that maybe we've never been before, but it's also an area that's just been absolutely decimated by, you know, a Category 5 hurricane. So the water's churned up. You're not going to be able to see anything. There could be debris floating right under the surface. You know, the winds are still howling pretty good. You know, you're still, even after several days after a hurricane, you're still going to end up with, you know, 20, 25 knot winds out there.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 32 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your passionate, enthusiastic, seaplane-loving host, Dan Bolton. If you're new to the show, On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats. My goal is to find the most interesting people in our industry to share their story to you bunch of seaplane-loving fans. As usual, my request to you all is simple. Tell a friend about the show, share it on social media, and review it on Apple Podcasts. It is super easy, takes only a minute, and it inspires me to keep up the hard work for you all. To get in contact with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at @thatmallardguy. Today I head to my second hometown of Florida to talk to Tropic Ocean Airways Captain Joshua Maddox. He shares his story about getting into floats, becoming an international seaplane captain, and what it's like to fly at one of the world's fastest growing seaplane companies. For now, folks, let's start up our EX Caravan Amphib. Descending the famous Miami seaplane base ramp, we'll enter the waters once home to Chalk's Ocean Airways flying boats. Conducting our multi-crew checklist, we'll brief the takeoff before getting up and on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A lot.
Okay, I'd like to welcome Joshua Maddox, all the way from my favourite place in the United States, a home that I'm getting a lot of interviews from, Florida, mate. Welcome to On The Step.
Awesome, Daniel. Thank you so much for having me on, man. Really, really excited to do this.
Absolute pleasure, mate. You are one of the Tropic Ocean Airways pilots flying the Cessna Caravan over there out of one of the most iconic seaplane locations in the world, thanks to the beautiful Chalk's Ocean Airways paving the way before you. How's life over there at Tropic Ocean, mate?
It's great. You know, we've definitely had some hurdles with the whole COVID thing, but we're doing the best that we can to make sure that we're still flying after this thing's said and done. So between that and then some of these hurricanes and tropical storms that we have blowing through, we've seen some hurdles over the last couple of months, but the flying's been good.
Happy days, mate. And you are working obviously under the man himself, Rob Serravolo. Mate, is he as badass as he sounds?
He's a pretty badass guy. You sit down, you get a little bit of time to talk to him as you did and hear some of his stories. I mean, he sits in a CEO position now, but he can throw that pilot hat on pretty quick and throw some really solid knowledge your way and teach you a thing or two, regardless of how long he's been out of the cockpit. So to answer your question, yeah, he's badass as he sounds.
That's the guy. That's what I wanted to hear. Did he share anything that you hadn't heard before, or was he kind of just throwing out some stories that he loves to tell everyone in that interview?
I think most of the stuff that was talked about or discussed, you know, is pretty general knowledge stuff. You know, I don't think there's anything too eye opening in there. You know,
he kept all the beer chat stories to himself, did he?
There are some that probably aren't suited for a podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I've got to come to Florida, man. I've got to come meet all you guys over there and
there you go.
Crack a few beers and.
I always hear you say on the podcast the best way to do it is to meet up with them after work and have a beer. So if you want to hear those stories, you're going to have to come sit around a table with us for a beer one night.
I promise I'll say not on record beforehand. I feel like maybe Bill won't trust me or something.
Fair enough.
No, absolutely, mate. Yeah, so awesome to get you on, Joshua, and we're going to talk all about your kind of story into float plane flying and hear some stories about your experience flying floats. But mate,
let's jump back at the start there and tell us a little bit about how you got into aviation and was seaplanes kind of on the agenda right at the start?
Yeah, so initially my first introduction to aviation was with my grandfather whenever I was a kid. He was part owner of a 172. He was a private pilot. And I can just remember being a kid, whenever I would go to visit, we'd load up and head to the airport, hop in his little 172. And they lived up in North Florida, so we'd fly up to Tallahassee or somewhere and grab a hamburger and fly home. And I just always was just completely mesmerized by how awesome it was that we could hop in this machine, fly over the top of everything, go get lunch and come back. It was just the coolest thing in the world to me. So kind of from that first flight, the whole time I was growing up, I always knew that being a pilot was what I wanted to do. Seaplanes, I was always really interested in them, and I knew that I wanted to get a seaplane rating. I just never thought that it was something that I would be able to make into a career. Whenever I thought about it or looked at it, it was, well, you know, eventually I'll make it to the airlines and maybe I'll buy a Cub on floats or a Mall on floats or something like that, just fly it around for fun. But then whenever I was presented with the opportunity to actually make a career out of it, that was just eye-opening and mind-blowing to me. And so that's kind of where the whole trajectory of my career path shifted. And I really started focusing on the seaplane stuff.
So where did you actually go and get your license? And what stage was that kind of transition into thinking that a seaplane career could actually, you know, be on the cards?
I did my private and instrument training at a small flight school up in Gainesville, Florida. And then once I wrapped up my instrument rating there, I transitioned into Embry-Riddle in Daytona Beach and finished up my commercial multi, and my degree at Embry-Riddle. Following that, I was fortunate enough to be offered a position to fly an aerial survey for one of the companies right there out of Daytona Beach. So I was flying a Piper Aztec all over the country for 2 years doing aerial photography. And it was at I still remember the conversation to this day, me and one of the other pilots, we were sitting down in the lobby of the hotel and we were kind of talking about what our plans were after we finished aerial survey, because we were both sort of towards the end of our second contracts and we were getting close to that 1500 hour mark where we were starting to look at different options. And I said, man, you know, I'm not super excited about the idea of the regionals, but at least once I get there or even get to a major and start making big money like that, maybe I'll be able to afford a little float plane. I can go have some fun and get my seaplane rating. And I was just kind of talking about how in general I was really excited for the possibility of that happening later down the road. And he said, well, I mean, you're from Florida. He said, do you know about Tropic Ocean Airways? I said, no, I've never heard of them before. So he started telling me about it. And I mean, I immediately fell in love just hearing him talk about them. But he had met Nick Veltri, who is our COO, at a job fair and got all of his information. So he passed that along to me. And I started reaching out to Nick. Him and I emailed back and forth for a while and then planned a day for me to just fly. At the time, I was working a project out in Salt Lake City, Utah. So we planned for me to hop on a commercial flight back down to Florida, spent the day with them, did an in-person interview, toured the facilities and everything. And I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, I had applications in at regionals, I had offers from different regionals, but, you know, I declined all those and just picked up the job at Tropic. So I was through all my flight training. I was kind of going into the next phase of my career path whenever the opportunity at Tropic presented itself. So couldn't be happier with the decision that I made.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Before we jump into that part of your career and move on to Tropic, I just want to ask a few questions before about what you said. Embry-Riddle, now that, you know, as an Aussie, this comes up in a lot of, you know, the fellow who runs LO Altitude seems to take the piss of Embry-Riddle a fair bit. what's the go there, mate? Can you give those Aussies a bit of a background on what the goings on of Embry-Riddle are?
Sure. So, I mean, and this isn't just for the Australian listeners. I mean, this is for the guys in the States too, who are maybe the young guys that are, or young guys or girls that are looking at the possibility to go to Riddle. The education is great, but I'm not sold that the price tag associated with it is completely worth it. You know, the facilities are fantastic. The aircraft are in great shape. The instructors are good. Availability is always there. There are a ton of resources to you as a student, but at the same time, you can get all the same ratings and experiences just going to your local flight school and pay, you know, next to nothing compared to what you pay to go to Riddle with a degree. So, frankly, knowing if I knew then what I know now and knew where I was going to be in my career, I probably would have not chosen to go to Embry-Riddle. I probably would have just stuck with the small flight school in my hometown and approached it that way. But for what it is, I mean, Riddle's a phenomenal school. Like I said, the aircraft are great. The facilities are top notch. I mean, the access that you have to some of the materials and hyperbaric chambers and all these different resources that you don't get anywhere else. It's really cool and it's a lot of fun, but you pay for it. It's not cheap. So,
yeah, right. So is it some sort of like airline preparation college or something like that? Sounds like where all the rich guys go and, you know, and then are expected to go straight into an airline. Is that the kind of vibe of the place?
Yeah. So there are different tracks. It is an aeronautical university. So everything at the university is based on aerospace, aeronautics, all these different fields. And then within the flight department, if I remember correctly, there were two tracks, the airline track, and then so the ATP track, and then what they call just the commercial track. So you could take specialized training if you knew you wanted to go 121. At the end of that course, you would have already taken the ATP written, and then I think you get somewhere around 12 hours in a CRJ full motion simulator, which is pretty cool. That's the route that I took, and it was a lot of fun. For the commercial route, generally, you end up going through Riddle's CFI, CFII, and MEI course, and then you sign a contract to flight instruct at the university for a certain amount of time. And then following that, they can pipeline you into like a program with Cape Air or one of the other smaller Part 135 operators that can then later pipeline you into, say, a JetBlue or something like that. So there are a ton of opportunities and pipelines coming out of the university. So for that sort of thing, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I guess it's pretty cool to have that. We've got a similar kind of course, I'd say, in Australia, but it's not a specific university that's completely, you know, aeronautics or, you know, aviation. So it's pretty special that you guys get the opportunity to have places like Embry-Riddle, I guess. One question is, if you return to be a flight instructor, are you a professor?
You're not considered a professor, no. I guess technically in the sense of the word, sure, you're a teacher, absolutely. But yeah, you know, I mean, you're teaching ground schools, you're doing flight instruction and all that. So, yeah, I mean, I guess at the school, you kind of would be considered a professor then.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. Why not put professor instead of instructor on your license?
I'm a flight professor. That exactly. Sounds nice, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? You should have done that route, mate. That would have looked really good on the resume.
Tell me about it. But, it really is kind of cool to be able to go into university as a freshman and already have your career path almost, you know, with guideposts all the way through it to your end goal of being a 121 captain at a major airline. Like, I mean, that's kind of cool when you think about it, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think that's kind of one of the benefits of the university.
Is there a football team in Embry-Riddle?
I don't think there was a football. There wasn't one whenever I was there. I think maybe prior to me being there years ago, they may have had one. But we're not exactly known for our sports outside of the flight team. I think the flight team does pretty well, but any of the other sports, I don't think we're very competitive.
There's probably definitely a beach volleyball team in Embry-Riddle though, surely.
Absolutely. There's beach everything.
Okay, fair enough. All the tough questions here at On the Step, mate.
Yeah, really getting down to the nitty gritty. I love exactly.
So back to that story, mate. So you've turned down some interviews, you said, or some job applications from some of the regionals there. Like, did that ever, you know, you'd got to that point in your career where they were actually starting to come in and you potentially could get onto a jet. Was that lure, you know, at all grabbing you and maybe pulling you back, or was it just 100% seaplane lifestyle for me?
It was a difficult decision. You know, and at the time, she was my fiance at the time, my wife now, her and I, you know, sat down and really just talked through each scenario. Hey, if I go with the regional, you know, there's down the road, there's the potential for much higher pay. But the downside is I'm going to be junior based for a while. At that point, I'd already been away from home for almost 2 years doing aerial survey. I was almost never home with that job, building hours. And my heart just really wasn't in the 121 jet pilot lifestyle. When I talked about flying the seaplanes, you know, it was really exciting. I'm home every single night. You know, I've been with the company long enough now where, you know, the pay is similar to what somebody with a decent amount of experience at a 121 airline is going to be getting paid. So, you know, you take your licks in the beginning, but in the end, it starts paying off. Like I said, with the joy of being able to fly these seaplanes to the Bahamas and be home with my wife every night. Those are really the two biggest determining factors for me, was not wanting to be away from home for weeks at a time anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine that, you know, down the track, you're going to be having kids and stuff like that. And, you know, that just adds to that whole want to be at home every night and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there are things that are going to happen in life that I don't want to have to miss. As much as I love flying and I love my career, I also love my family and I want to be able to spend time with them. So this has kind of delivered the opportunity to me to be able to fly awesome airplanes to beautiful places and then also spend a great deal of time with my friends and family. So it's been a nice balance.
What about, are there any other float operators in the States, do you think, that kind of offer that absolute change of lifestyle by working at a seaplane company rather than going to the airlines? Like, obviously I could imagine, you know, the size of Tropic now, it's getting quite up there, and you know, you've got multi-crew and whatnot, and I would think that Rob would encourage some better salaries to keep you guys around, especially with your experience. Is there any other companies in the States there that offer that similar lifestyle?
There is. There's one in particular. Unfortunately, a couple of months ago, the other, which was Shoreline, they've been around for, geez, I'd say it was like 50 years or something they had operated.
Wow.
And unfortunately, they were purchased by Cape Air, and then Cape Air really didn't know what to do with it, so they closed the doors, which is just really, really sad, because John Kelly, the guy that founded the company, just an amazing guy and a fantastic seaplane pilot, you know, his life's work was just kind of boarded up within a couple of months of his passing and then the selling of the airline. So we had Shoreline, Fly the Whale, and us were really the main three. Now that Shoreline is boarded up, it's kind of just us and Fly the Whale up in the Northeast. They offer, you know, similar circumstances that we do. You know, they're two pilot crews, but the majority of their work is up in the Northeast. So they're kind of New York area.
Yep. And then what about, like, say, Alaska? Do you think that a pilot could kind of avoid having a career in the airlines if they were to become a full-time Alaskan pilot? Obviously, anyone can kind of stick around in GA and fly seaplanes for their whole life. There's no issue there. But I guess, like you said, relative to what your conditions were about being at home and still having some sort of healthy financial position, what are your thoughts on Alaska?
Sure. I think Alaska is a great option for anybody that wants to go out there and do it. You know, that's a, you know, you had Dion on who's an amazing seaplane pilot and a dear friend of mine. He flew with us at Tropic for a while. But you heard him talk about how it's just a different lifestyle up there. Like, you have to want to be there to go up there and do that. So if it's something that somebody's passionate about and they want to go up there and be a part of that, I think Alaska is an amazing opportunity. You just have to kind of deal with the seasonality of the flying up there. You know, float planes are only part of the season. Then the other half of the season is from what I understand, pretty serious IFR, you know, in mountainous terrains with icing. So, you know, I wouldn't imagine that anybody would be able to go up there with 250 hours in a fresh commercial and get a job. But maybe building up to 600, 700 hours somewhere else, then going up there would probably be a good bet. Maybe get a job bouncing around in a 206 or something until they can get you in something bigger.
Now, mate, you spoke about what you did to build your hours to get this job at Tropic. What other kind of options are there in the States to building some times as a 250 or 150-hour commercial-rated pilot? What's the kind of route that most people go down?
I'm not very familiar with what it's like in Australia or anywhere else. I feel like the States, that we have a lot of options available to us to be able to build that time. So for starters, obviously operators like ours, where we're operating a two pilot crew with an FAA approved SIC program, we can bring you in at 250 hours, throw you in the right seat. You can build all that time up to the minimums until you can move on, or if you want to upgrade to captain with us. There's also banner towing. So especially in Florida, banner towing along the shoreline is huge. So I've got a lot of friends that built time just towing banners up and down the up and down the coast. Aerial survey, I think personally, not just because I did it, but just for the experience that it gives you and the amount of time, I think is an amazing option. It's extremely competitive and it is hard to get the job, but once you get it, you can build up to that time extremely quickly. And all that time is built, you know, cross country, single pilot, you know, your aeronautical decision making and everything that you do in the cockpit is just really honed in and sharpened for all of the time that you build doing that job. And then the last route really, you know, would be like the CFI, CFIIs, MEIs, doing the flight instruction. So I think there's a lot of options out there for the low time pilot to get into the seat and build some of that time to get to whatever their next goal is. And then, you know, kind of the golden goose, I guess, would be finding that Part 91, you know, King Air or something like that, where you know somebody or you kind of get connected with it. Where you get thrown into an airplane that, you know, generally a pilot with low time wouldn't have the opportunity to fly. But I've heard it happen, and I'm always super excited for the low time pilot that gets to build time that way.
Now, as I mentioned before, it sounds like a bit of a land of opportunity over there sometimes in the States. There are just so many different avenues to take, and aviation really is well supported all over the country, I imagine, with all of your little airports and air shows and everything. It's on the top of my bucket list to get over there and see you guys and start doing a bit more flying over in the States. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, the GA industry over here is phenomenal. I mean, it's so well supported. So there's just, you know, the options really are endless.
Yeah, it helps when, you know, our countries, United States and Australia, are roughly about the same size, whereas your population, I think, 350 million or something like that. Versus 26 million. Unfortunately, Australia is just so spread out, which makes general aviation sometimes a bit not worthwhile to take your airplane to fly those distances. You know, built-up cities have got their general aviation working reasonably well, but you know, when it takes the whole country as a whole, it's very lacking, unfortunately. And, you know, I've just become a member of the SPA or part of the committee of the Seaplane Pilots Association in Australia here. And it's just really hard to run or to organise, you know, like a fly-in, for example, because you move a fly-in anywhere around the country and a lot of these pilots have almost got to fly the whole length of the coast on the east coast and you're only kind of gathering kind of 10, 15 people. So it does make life a bit difficult in that regard. But, yeah, absolutely. Like I said, the land of opportunity over there in the States. I've got a lot of Aussie mates over there who are over there flying the regionals and kind of building ours that way as well. So they'll even let us in, which is great. so, mate, tell us about, you know, you've got that dream job now, I guess, at Tropic Ocean. What was it like at the start there? How did you get into your float endorsement? Did you do that through Tropic? And then what was the progression there from the right seat to the left?
Yeah, so I did not have my float endorsement whenever I was offered the position, but it was made very clear to me that, you know, if I showed up for day one of training and I didn't have my float endorsement done, that the job offer was now revoked. So immediately, as soon as they offered me the job, I went ahead and scheduled to get my float rating at Jack Brown's up in Winter Haven, kind of world famous seaplane instruction up there. Over the years, gotten extremely close with the Brown family. So fortunate to be able to say that I went up there and got my seaplane rating. And then in the beginning at Tropic, it was tough. You know, coming into the company, I was already at 1,500 hours. I met all the 121 minimums. But I knew coming into it that I was going to be sitting in the right seat, because this is a world that I didn't know. So I had to kind of come in as if I was a blank slate and just soak up all of the knowledge and experiences of all these guys around me that had, you know, thousands and thousands of seaplane hours. And whenever I came in, there really wasn't even a position for a pilot available. So I wound up doing dispatch for about 3 months before I even saw the inside of an airplane. After that 3 months, I started flying, started gaining some experience in the caravan from the right seat. And about 3 months after that was when I was offered a PIC position in our land-based caravan, which, of course, I accepted that. And that gave me the opportunity to fly in the left seat of the land van and really kind of build my PIC mentality, because up to that point, everything that I'd flown was single pilot. Now I'm in a two-pilot crew, so I have to figure out how to kind of navigate that, how I'm going to run my cockpit. And I flew the left seat of the land plane for, I think, 6 months. And on days where it was possible, I would fly the right seat of the seaplane to build experience there. And then after, it was actually the 1 year anniversary to my initial check ride with the company was when I got my Amphib PIC upgrade check ride. So 12 months to the day, I was upgraded and flying in the left seat of the Amphib as a captain. So that was a pretty special day for me. You know, all the hard work and everything that I've been putting in kind of culminated in at the end of that check ride. So it was a pretty awesome day.
Yeah, it's a pretty quick upgrade, I guess, from absolutely zero float time into, you know, being the left seat captain of a Cessna Caravan, a pretty complex aeroplane. I imagine that was your first turbine aircraft as well.
It was, yes.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so you got the turbine aspect, maybe even the glass cockpit aspect as well, plus multi-crew and seaplane operation. So to do that within a year, I think that's a pretty incredible feat.
It was, you know, it was drinking from a fire hose, but, you know, I went into it with a goal. I knew what I wanted to accomplish, and, you know, the company was great. They supported me in every way possible and kind of told me, hey, you hit these, you know, as you hit these check marks, and then this is, you know, this is what you, these are the things you need to do to get into the left seat of the seaplane. So for that first year, I kept my head down. All I did was focus on my flying and how I could get better. And fortunately, I was offered the upgrade with, I think I was sitting on about 250 to 300 hours seaplane, which is kind of a low number. Generally, we're looking for more around 500 hours before we move somebody over into the left seat. So I felt very fortunate to be offered that upgrade as quickly as I was.
Tell us a little bit about the actual way the multi-crew works in the caravan. I've flown multi-crew in two different operations, one Amphib EX caravan and one just on wheels in an IFR only role. How's the duty split? Is the guy in the right-hand seat simply just a checklist reader, or is he fully doing exactly what the guy on the left does, other than obviously start the engine because of where the start controls are?
Yeah, so our right seat SICs, they are required crew through our GOM and op spec. So they go through a full-blown Part 135 check ride. They have to do yearly check rides. They have to stay IFR current. So they're doing everything from the right seat that the guy in the left seat is doing. And the way that we look at it is those guys and girls that are sitting in the right seat, we are every single day that we fly with them, we are trying to pass something along to them that's going to help them move over into the left seat. So we say that our SICs are always PICs in training, all of them. That's just how we view them. So they're expected to be able to operate that aircraft at an extremely high level. So they're not just over there reading a checklist or helping the PIC get the thing roped to the dock or swinging gear or anything like that. They are a required crew member.
What are the stuff that they actually cannot do because of the operation? Like, as I mentioned, for example, the engine start. I don't want to focus on negatives in a way, but I'd just like to kind of get an idea of, what are the aspects of the job that only the pilot in command can do in that airplane?
So the big obvious one is fly any leg from the left seat. So obviously an SIC, we can't just throw them over into the left seat and have them fly a Part 135 leg from the left seat. We also don't allow that to happen on a Part 91 leg unless they are part of a specific upgrade program and they're flying with a company instructor. In that case, we will allow them to fly from the left seat. We do not allow them to start the engine. Again, now if they're part of this special upgrade program, we do all this training with them individually at a later time. There's really not a whole lot that we don't allow these guys to do.
Docking
the right seat. So again, this is how all of this is going to go. If they're part of that specialized upgrade track, then I will take them out and do specialized docking practice with them. But just on a day-to-day operation like Part 135, we're going up to a dock to drop passengers off. No, we do not allow them to dock the aircraft.
And I just want to clear up, maybe for some of the listeners, the whole Part 91 versus Part 135 there. Can you just quickly give us a quick rundown on the differences there?
Yeah, so simply put, Part 91 are any legs where we don't have paying passengers on the aircraft anytime the plane's not for hire. Part 135 legs are where we have paying passengers on the aircraft.
Okay, perfect.
So if we're flying down to the Exumas to pick a group up from a yacht, the flight out there is empty. That would be considered Part 91. Once we get the paying passengers on the aircraft and turn the plane around, now that's Part 135.
So talk about that upgrade process from being an FO into SIC into the PIC position. As you mentioned, you're going to go out there and you're going to start to learn about all the engine start procedures, the docking procedures. What's the process from moving to the right to the left?
Yeah, so we have a kind of an outline of the entire training program. So like you said, it starts off with a lot of the limitations on the aircraft, engine start limitations. We really just kind of hammer out and make sure that all of the book knowledge is there before we even move to any of the real fundamentals of seaplane or actually flying the aircraft. So we'll end up doing several, ground sessions just to make sure that all the book knowledge is where it needs to be. Then following that, we actually have access to a 208 sim where we can go practice engine starts and then throw emergencies at the candidate. So we might throw them a hung start or a hot start so they can see what those look like. You can sit and talk through what a hot start looks like, but it's immensely more valuable to sit them in a sim, give them a hot start so they can actually see it, so they can recognize it if it ever happens to them. So once we get them through the engine start and emergency procedures sim, then we move on to the aircraft where we start allowing them to start the aircraft. We'll let them taxi it to the hangar. Then as the training flights start progressing, that's when we'll start looking at taking them to some of the more open water areas to work on some of the rough water takeoffs, rough water landings, those sorts of things. We really focus on crosswind landings and crosswind takeoffs, because some of these channels that we're going in and out of, it's one way in, one way out. And if it's blowing 20 knots across that channel, you've got to be able to get that plane down safely. So the rough water stuff and the crosswinds are probably the two things that we're really focused on the most. Then, you know, there are the challenges of docking and getting to a mooring ball, ramping at the seaplane base in Miami. So we really just spend a lot of time just over and over and over and over again, every chance we get, giving them the opportunity to experience and kind of hone their skills at all these different sort of seaplane fundamentals.
And how long is the actual process from being in that right to the left? Is there an hour requirement that the SIC has to meet before they jump in the left?
No, it's not so much an hour requirement. It's more performance-based than that. But on average, it generally takes somebody, once we start really focusing on them as an upgrade, about 6 months to get from the right seat to the left seat.
Wow. Yeah, that's a long period, I guess. But I imagine that the amount of places that you guys go and the different conditions that you could experience in this company, you need a lot of time in those different roles. And are they actually kind of acting as both crew sometimes? Like, is there some legs where they'll only just be an SIC because it's not specifically a training sector, or do you target certain legs like those Part 91 legs to have them in the left seat?
Yeah. So that's what we'll do, is we'll pair that candidate who's in training for upgrade. We'll pair them with company instructors, and they'll go out and fly the line together for a day. And on those empty legs, any opportunity that the PIC sees to give the candidates an opportunity to train something, they'll give it to them. So, you know, if you're going to a dock empty to pick people up, well, then the PIC may say, hey, you take the left seat, you dock the airplane, I'm going to talk you through it. You know, so we really try to maximize the amount of training and real world training that we're giving these the candidates to make them the best seaplane pilots that we can.
Yeah, very cool. Mate, what are the biggest challenges for pilots at Tropic Ocean there? With regards to, you mentioned kind of crosswinds and rough water, like how many different locations are you going to, and you know, what are the biggest challenges you find as a pilot?
Gosh, how many? It's hard to say locations, because we'll go anywhere in the Bahamas. So I guess you could say the locations are endless. But the rough water and the crosswinds initially were probably some of the most challenging things to deal with. During our windy season here, we can have up to 2 weeks solid where the winds are just howling at 25 knots nonstop. And we're still out there, you know, trying to get the job done. I shouldn't say trying. We're still out there getting the job done. now that I've been with the company for, you know, 4.5 years, I've got a fair amount of seaplane experience under my belt. Now it's sort of become one of my responsibilities to be the guy that goes out and flies to some of these new locations that maybe we've never been before, we've never seen it. All I can do is look it up in a chart and then maybe go on Google Earth and take a look at it and try to figure out how we're going to get in and out of some of these areas. So that's probably one of the biggest challenges now is kind of scouting some of these new locations that we haven't been to before, because we're always expanding. We'll always get a phone call, somebody wanting us to go somewhere in the Bahamas that we've never been before, and being able to look at it and make a determination of whether we can get in and out of there safely.
And the reasons for those new locations, are they new clients on board, say, for an island, or are they generally just like private yachts that you're going to and they're just parked up in some different bay you haven't been to?
Yeah, a lot of them are just yachts that are anchored in a bay we've never been to. You know, a lot of the new locations, it'll just be somebody that's either trying to get to their yacht or get off of their yacht.
Yeah, right. And tell us a little bit about the Bahamas and how that all, you know, how many islands are there? And, you know, it sounds like a pretty extensive kind of area to operate in.
It is. I mean, it extends. It's a huge area. But we operate almost anywhere that is requested of us in the Bahamas. There are some areas that are so far south that it starts getting outside of our our ability to get there and back with fuel. But for the most part, we're able to get just about anywhere. We've done trips. I've done flights down to Turks and Caicos. I did a yacht transfer in Cuba, which was pretty amazing to be able to have the opportunity to do that. We've got planes down in Puerto Rico, BVI, so we're kind of all over the place out there.
Yeah, no, it does look, I'm just also jumping on Google there. What do we got here? We got over 700.
700, yep. I just found 700 islands out there. So at least 700 places that somebody could call and ask us to land.
Well, no, you know, four times that, because you could be on either side of those islands, I guess. Some of those islands. Yeah. What an incredible place. You know, you're flying internationally every day into the Bahamas there. You know, what happens there if you go to pick up someone off their private yacht? Surely they don't have customs just right next door to them because you're going over there in your seaplane to fly them back to the States. Like, how does that process all work?
Sure. So it's all paperwork, of course. So we have a great team that coordinates with Bahamian Customs, U.S. Customs, to clear us out of the U.S. going into the Bahamas. Then once we get into the Bahamas, we have to stop at the first port of entry. The customs officer will clear us into the Bahamas, and then we have a document that we fill out. It's called a transire, and that is a Bahamian form that gives us the permission to travel from that port of entry to wherever the next location is to pick these people up. So we then travel via transire from the port of entry to either the island, the house, the yacht, wherever we're going. We pick the people up, then we have to stop back at a port of entry on the way out to clear out from the Bahamas.
Wow.
So then we go in, we take all the passengers in, Customs and Immigration clears the aircraft and all the passengers out of the country, out of the Bahamas. We continue on to the U.S., and then whichever, you know, if we are either going into Miami or into Fort Lauderdale, we then have to clear back into U.S. Customs. So it's a lot of clearing customs.
Is there a certain spot that you go to every time you, like you leave Fort Lauderdale there? Is there one spot straight away that's like you'll just go there initially, no matter where the client is?
We have extremely convenient Bahamian ports of entries that we use. There's one on the island of Andros that is sort of centralized to all of the main locations that we go to. So that's generally the one that we'll use is right there on Andros.
And they generally, they're located at a land airport, I imagine?
Yes. Yeah, we have had instances where we've been able to coordinate with Customs and Immigration, and they might take a boat out to a yacht to clear them at the vessel, but that's pretty rare. That generally doesn't happen too often.
Yeah, right. And like, the Bahamas are quite spread out there, and then you also talked about going to the British Virgin Islands as well. What's the kind of flight time all the way down there?
Jeez, I think to get to the BVI is like 8 hours. We generally fly down, stop in Turks and Caicos for fuel, and then continue down to Antigua. And I want to say it's between 7 and 8 hours in the caravan.
Yeah, wow. That must be a pretty specific charter to run a caravan on such a long sector.
Well, that's not the scheduled route from Florida to Antigua. The plane, we've repositioned the airplane to Antigua, and then we fly for a resort out there from the airport out to the island.
Geez, there must be some money involved if they're ferrying caravans for 16 hours to get to these islands.
Well, like I said, that plane is down there full time when that operation's running.
Okay,
so
there you go. So, I imagine it's coming back for some sort of maintenance. Is it?
Yeah, or, well, we have a full maintenance staff down there that covers the maintenance, but the aircraft comes back when the resort closes for the season. Just like everything else in the tropics, that resort is seasonal. So they've actually closed down now with the whole COVID thing and getting to the slow portion of the year. So they'll reopen. We'll reposition the crew and the airplane back down there probably sometime in November, beginning of November.
Have you had a run down there yourself, working out of the BVI?
I actually got to go down and fly between Puerto Rico and Virgin Gorda for about 5 days, which was just unbelievable. Going down there and, you know, you're flying through this crystal clear, beautiful water, but it's got mountains and some terrain. You know, the Bahamas are beautiful, but it's all very flat. So being able to kind of get the beauty of that Caribbean water mixed with some terrain and some mountains, it was just unreal. And then I don't know if you're familiar with the runway at Virgin Gorda or not, but it's extremely short and it's just a dirt strip on the side of a mountain down there. And it was an extremely challenging runway to get in and out of, but boy, was it fun doing it. We had an absolute blast down there.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I mean, I heard Michael Steers' episode, obviously. He spoke about flying down the U.S. Virgin Islands there and everything, and you know, in the Mallards back in the day. It's incredible kind of stuff around that area. So, yeah, I'd love to get in a plane and fly down there for sure. And the Bahamas look incredible from the air as well.
Yeah. It's stunning out there. It doesn't matter how long I do it. Every time I fly over the top, it's like, man, this place is unreal.
Yeah. So you spoke about having those bases. How much of the work there that you guys do is seasonal kind of flying?
So any of the bases away from Florida are all seasonal. So Antigua is seasonal. Puerto Rico base is seasonal. Our operation up in New York is seasonal. So anything away from the Fort Lauderdale, Miami area is all based on the season.
So do you have pilots as well that are seasonal, or do you guys all just stay on board and maybe migrate back to Fort Lauderdale when things are slow?
Yeah, so we got an amazing group of guys, and everybody just stays on board and just kind of goes back and forth. So it's pretty awesome. It's a lot of fun.
And does the flying really drop off for you guys during that period, or are you kind of enough work around Fort Lauderdale to keep busy?
Generally, there's plenty of work to bring all of the crews and the planes back here and keep everybody busy. You know, this season is a little bit of it's a bit of an anomaly because I guess it's not a knot. We know exactly what's going on with all the COVID stuff. You know, we've seen a even further decrease. This is generally our slow time of the year, but it's been even more slow than it normally would be. So on any other year, yes, we'd be able to bring those airplanes and crew back and keep everybody going until we get into, you know, November, December, into the holiday seasons. But this year it's just unusually slow.
Yeah, I think everyone's feeling that, aren't they, at the moment?
Yeah. I don't think that's news to anybody.
No, exactly. Now, mate, you mentioned prior to us having a little chat here that you're about to kind of batten down the hatches a little bit because there's a chance for a cyclone to come through. What's the progress there?
Yeah, so the majority of the day today has been spent trying to coordinate all the aircraft and get everything ready. Looks like we're going to wind up getting hit. Right now, it's a tropical depression. It's just southeast of the Bahamas, but they're saying that by the time it gets into the Bahamas and into Florida, we could be looking at a Category 1 hurricane, which for anybody outside of Florida, that might sound terrible. For Floridians, we're kind of like, that's not even worth pulling the car in the garage. we're at Tropic. We're taking it super serious. We're going to probably close up shop, and obviously these timelines shift as we are monitoring the storm. But for now, we're looking at probably closing down shop early Sunday afternoon, and we'll probably move all the flights off the schedule Monday because that's when it's supposed to be moving through, and then hopefully be able to resume flight operations on Tuesday morning. So, you know, we just have to get everything ready, put all the planes in a hangar, and hope for the best.
Yeah. I should have used the word term hurricane before. We use the term cyclone over here in Australia. But hurricane sounds so much worse, I reckon. It sounds terrible.
They definitely they can be awful, awful things, that's for sure.
Does the operation get affected often by hurricanes, especially this time of the year?
Yeah, I mean, we're towards the end of hurricane season now, but yeah, it definitely affects us every time one blows through. Knock on wood, we've been pretty fortunate so far this season. In the past seasons, we've actually had to have crews and their families load up into the airplanes and fly the planes, you know, up north out of the path of when it's a bad hurricane, if it's a category 2, 3, 4, something like that. We don't want our aircraft getting damaged. So we'll load all the pilots and employees and their families into the airplanes and just fly them, you know, up to Nashville or something like that. But fortunately, we haven't had a storm bad enough this season that's warranted us to do that. And hopefully we won't. It definitely affects the operation. And it also affects where we operate. You know, the Bahamas, as a lot of people know, they're absolutely devastated by a hurricane last year. And, you know, we spent several weeks flying aid out to these islands that were just knocked off the map with this storm that sat over the top of them for 48 hours. I mean, it was devastating. So it doesn't just affect us at home. You know, it affects the areas that we operate and the friends that we have in the Bahamas, you know. So even if we get lucky and we don't get hit, you know, it's either going to be the Bahamas or it's going to be us. So it's never fun either way.
No, I couldn't imagine so. And once again, Michael Steers talked about how the Virgin Islands there were completely destroyed and that closed down the operation there for the Mallards running those scheduled flights around those areas. So, you know, it can have devastating effects on businesses, on people's homes and livelihoods, which I'm sure you've seen firsthand. Now, Rob spoke about some relief work that you guys did for the Bahamas a couple of years ago. Were you involved in that in any way?
Yeah, I was. So you asked a question earlier about what's like one of the challenges for the pilots at Tropic. And that was something else I was going to touch on is this hurricane relief that we've done. You know, every time the Bahamas have gotten hit really hard, we jump in there because there's a time period where the only way to get supplies in or people out might be via seaplane. So our pilots are phenomenal at jumping in there and saying, hey, you know what? We don't know what this area looks like. I don't know what's in the water. I don't know what's going on there, but I'm going to fly in there. And if there are people there, I'm going to get them out or I'm going to bring them, you know, food and water. So that's a really challenging thing. Anytime we're doing any of this hurricane relief work or anything like that, you're going into not only an area that maybe we've never been before, but it's also an area that's just been absolutely decimated by, you know, a category 5 hurricane. So the water's churned up. You're not going to be able to see anything. There could be debris floating right under the surface. You know, the winds are still howling pretty good. You know, you're still, even after several days after a hurricane, you're still going to end up with, you know, 20, 25 knot winds out there. You're dealing with people that are shell-shocked because they've just survived a hurricane and they just want to get off of this island, you know. So for our pilots, I think that's probably one of the most challenging things is being there and executing these hurricane relief flights as well as we do. So it's just a phenomenal team.
Yeah, no, good on you guys. That's an amazing effort. I don't know if you heard the episode I did with Michael Barksdale about the Albatross. He said that he was going to try and join up with you that year and have the Albatross join in.
Yes. Yep. That would have been unreal to see that thing parked next to one of our caravans. I would have absolutely loved to have seen that.
Hopefully he kind of gets involved in one, I'm sure that'll happen in the future and can kind of help out you guys and offer a bit of relief. Sounds like they really love, you know, helping out and getting involved down there as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be excellent.
Incredible. Mate, now also, you know, it's pretty hard to avoid the topic of the fact that the Mallard operation down there at the Miami Seaplane Base was something that was basically iconic in that area for so long. Do you have any memories of Chalk's probably well before your time, I imagine. But what's it like also operating out of that same area that, you know, was once home to one of the oldest airlines in the world, really, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And it's a really special feeling to be able to go in and out of that seaplane base and operate where those guys used to be in and out of there. Even now, whenever you're going up the ramp, there's the old neon chalk sign still on the side of the seaplane base. You know, when you go inside, they still have some of the old memorabilia hanging from the roof and stuff. So they really still, the owners still kind of keep that legacy alive, which is fantastic to see, because it's kind of an honor to be able to go in there and operate in and out of that seaplane base. And, you know, I've had the privilege to work with some of the pilots that worked at Chalks. Our chief pilot, whenever I was first hired, was one of their pilots. Just an amazing guy, an amazing pilot. So being down in that area with the history that Chalks has down there, and being able to sort of be a part of that is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's incredible, mate. The history, as you mentioned, in that area is very special. All righty, Josh, we're getting towards the end of the interview here, and we want to talk a little bit about our seaplane splash and dash questionnaire, just like the landplane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash. We're going to touch on a few seaplane-related questions here. First of all, have you actually flown any other types of seaplanes other than what you did in your training and the Cessna Caravan?
Yes, I did the Cub during training, the Caravan, and then I've got some time in our 206. So I get to every once in a while, I get to hop in our 206 and buzz around in that thing.
What are you using the 206 for?
We fly it down to some resorts in the Keys that, you know, maybe it's just a little too close or a little too expensive. People don't want to spend the money on a Caravan. We can offer them the 206. So kind of a neat change of pace to go from the Caravan with that big PT6 in the front and Beta and all the things that make your life easy, and be able to hop in the 206 and just kind of get back to the basics and just have some fun doing seaplane things.
Absolutely. And that's just run single pilot, that trip, is it?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Right. Now that'd be good fun to get back into that smaller seaplane, I reckon, and have, you know, throw it around a bit more and have a bit of fun. And that just runs to the Keys, hey?
Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, it's not really, you know, doesn't make much financial sense to try to charter it or send it anywhere else.
Yeah. No, fair enough. And out of those three aircraft, what so far has been your favorite seaplane that you've flown?
Oh, the Caravan, without a doubt.
It's got a great cockpit, I reckon, the Caravan. It's such a pilot's cockpit. You know, the power of the PD6 and I guess the presence of having, you know, 12 people behind you as well. Like, it just gives you that great feeling, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And the ramp presence of that thing is like nothing I've ever experienced. You know, I'm sure you get it whenever you show up in the Mallard, you know, where everybody on the ramp is just turned and like, whoa, look at that. You know, you kind of get the same thing with the Caravan whenever it shows up on the ramp. You know, that thing is just so big with the floats. It's a real pleasure to fly.
You can only imagine what it's like in Vietnam when you drive that thing up the ramp and there's all these Vietnamese on little scooters driving around. Never seen anything like it before. They rush over to see what the hell's going on.
Oh, sure. I'm sure. Everybody with their phones out snapping pictures.
Yep. You've got a lake, a river. You've got lots of lakes over in Florida. I know that. Open ocean or some sort of coral cay. What's been your favorite or best place to land a seaplane so far?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd have to say some kind of key, you know, some kind of coral key, well protected. I mean, the you know, just thinking about the Bahamas, the water and the scenery out there is so spectacular. But I guess really, you know, I've done the Bahamas thing. I've done a season in New York, and you're landing on the East River in New York. That's a different kind of beautiful up there. So being that, I have to say either a coral key or a river.
Yeah, well, it must be an incredible contrast going from the Bahamas to landing right next to the New York, you know, Manhattan skyline. That must be incredible.
It is. It's a bit shocking on your first, you know, you had Sarah on and she talked about it, but it really is, you kind of have to, retrain your mind to focus on the job at hand so that you're not caught just looking out the window with your mouth open. You know,
it's incredible.
It really is spectacular, and it's challenging, but like I said, it's beautiful in a completely different way.
Yeah. Now, mate, you spoke to Justin, our great mate over there at Pilot to Pilot, doing an incredible show of interviewing all types of different pilots in the aviation industry, and I think you can see where I'm going with this. But what is your dream seaplane to fly? I love the answer that you gave him in that one.
Well, it hasn't changed because I haven't gotten to fly it yet. So I'd have to go with a Mallard for sure.
That's a go.
Also, I do have to add on the back end of that, also an Air Cam. I want the opportunity to fly an Amphib Air Cam. That is something that I will do soon, hopefully.
That's one of the great things about this podcast for me personally, running it and interviewing all these people everywhere. And I guess people listening are probably going to find that as well. But the Air Cam was something that I wasn't really familiar with until kind of starting this and talking to people. And it's popping up everywhere now, and lots of people are talking about this Air Cam. So you have to check it out a bit more.
Yeah, yeah. Just a very cool airplane. I think it was originally designed when the Discovery Channel was filming Planet Earth. They needed something that could get some of those close shots but still fly pretty slow with an open cockpit. And I think that's what they came up with, and they threw some floats on it. And just a super cool airplane.
Absolutely. Now, do you think you're in it right now? What is your dream seaplane job?
I think I'm there. I think I've got it. I mean, I'm born and raised in Florida. My wife, all her family's down here in South Florida. So, you know, I'm getting to fly seaplanes, and I'm home every night, and I'm in the same state that I grew up in. My parents aren't too far north. So I'm just as happy as I can be here.
That's pretty incredible, mate. Like we mentioned before, you know, that difference between the airlines and the regionals, for example, you know, you could end up being away from family, and it's not often that pilots get to live in the area they grew up in and then eventually move into a job right in that same area and, like you said, be home every night. So, yeah, I think you're in a pretty good spot there right now.
Yeah, I'm like I said, I have not regretted the decision that I made 4.5 years ago once. So I'm very happy.
Absolutely. And finally, mate, you must meet a lot of young pilots coming through, especially wanting to become seaplane pilots in your job because of the way that you offer that entry into an SIC position. What kind of advice would you give to any of those pilots who want to follow the route that you've done and become a seaplane pilot?
I think probably the and this is going to seem like, you know, I'm not putting any like mind-blowing wisdom on anybody, but just go get that seaplane rating, you know? I can't tell you how, and I mean, I'm speaking from a different place because I didn't have it whenever I got the job, which was lucky for me. But, you know, had I gotten it and there was any question, when you throw that resume down, if you already have the seaplane rating, that resume immediately goes to the top of the stack, you know? So if you're interested in seaplanes and you want to get a job as a seaplane pilot, go ahead and just pull the trigger, go get that seaplane rating. It might be a little pricey, but I can promise you it's the most fun you're ever going to have in an airplane. So whether you ever use it again, and even if you don't get hired as a seaplane pilot, like, you are absolutely going to have a blast doing that thing. So just get that knocked out so that you can throw that on your resume. Outside of that, you know, every single person that you've had on has said it. You've said it. We kind of touched on it at the beginning of this episode, but show up, go grab a beer with us whenever we get done flying. You know, help washing planes, you know, sweeping hangars, stuff like that. Just being around, because, like you said, a lot of times when a position comes open, you know, the guy that's around the corner is going to be the one to get the job, not the one that's, you know, 7 states away and needs 3 weeks to get moved down here.
Yeah, no, great shout out, mate. Well done, well said. So for anyone who'd like to check out what Josh is doing there, you got a great little Instagram page there, mate, _
Oh, thank you.
Joshua Maddox, M-A-D-D-O-X, underscore again at the end, double underscore. I love the use of that. And you can see all of his amazing photos of flying the Cessna Caravan around the Bahamas there. I'm just having a look at it now, mate. There's some incredible photos there. Reminds me of my time flying in the Whitsundays. And
oh, man.
Yeah, pretty good spot as well.
Yeah, spectacular out there. That's a bucket list too, is to go out there and take one of those beavers out to the reef.
Yeah, so you mentioned that prior to us coming online that you're thinking about coming over and doing a bit of a seaplane tour of Australia. So we'd love to have you up here and take you for a run on the Mallard, mate, if you're in town. So, but for now, Josh, it's been great chatting with you, mate, and really enjoyed having you on the step.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, man. I've really enjoyed it.
And that's the show for today, folks. Thanks to Josh for sharing his stories and giving me another reason to visit Florida. Now is the time to share this podcast, tell a friend, and review with Apple Podcasts. Thanks to those who do so regularly. Folks, next episode is huge. We all dread the gear down water landing. You all know of my passion to help prevent others doing this in the future. Well, coming up on the next episode of On The Step is not just one, but two survivors of gear down water landings. They share incredible insights into what happens when your day goes from sunshine and happiness to fighting for your life underwater.
And as I said, I was watching the silhouette of the airplane to where it would touch the water to see how graceful it was going to look, but it was everything but. As soon as it touched, it was, you know, I've used the term that the airplane face planted and went inverted almost in its own length. That's probably not true. Maybe it's two lengths, but it's very fast. And when it impacted and nosed over, it was the equivalent of a fire hose being turned onto your face with shreds of plastic and metal in that stream of water as it ripped through that airplane. And we immediately settled upside down with people hanging upside down in their seats.
This episode is incredible and a must listen for everyone. But until then, thanks for coming on The Step.